Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Bear Cricket. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left for this special episode of TCCP is none other than former Middlesex, Surrey and Worcestershire wicketkeeper batsman, Ben Scott. So Ben, first things first, thank you very much for joining me here on the podcast today, mate. How's your day been so far?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks, Aaron. I think I'm sitting on your right, aren't I? Rather than the left, but who knows, from sunny old London. all good down here, mate. All good.
Excellent. That's what we like to see, Ben. Yeah, it is confusing. With Zoom on my screen, you're actually on my left. That's right, just lovely. How it works. It flips. But yeah, fortunately, we don't have to have the video for this, so there's no confusion there. But yes, for all of the listeners out there then, basically today's podcast with Ben, we're just going to be talking about his early cricketing journey, his favourite moments from his time down at Lord's with Middlesex, and then of course we'll end today's episode with a nice classic game of this or that. So Ben, to kickstart today's episode then, let's go right back to the origin of the Ben Scott cricketing journey. What were your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching the game?
Wow, okay. So I suppose, I mean, my dad used to play for a wandering side called the Primitives back in the day. And great name. And it was just an amalgamation of mates, really, that just grabbed whatever game they could and just went wherever they could and played a couple of games of cricket. And then I think when I was sort of 11 years old, I managed to kind of play a couple of games with him, you know, sort of field and stuff like that. I was probably a bit younger than that. And yeah, he basically said to me, what do you want? I also played football as well. And he kind of, you know, put the decision in my hands and said, well, what do you want to play? But unfortunately for me, I'd say that he asked me during the summer. And obviously being like a 7 or 8 year old, I've gone, I want to play cricket, Dad. You know, had he asked me in February, who knows? Who knows where I could be now? But yeah, so that's how it all kind of started back in the day.
That's an interesting origin story then. Yeah, so could have been a footballer. And I suppose I have to ask out of interest, who would you have gone with? If you had a choice to play for any football team in the world, who would your choice be?
Oh, do you know what? I actually, we'll probably get onto the whole sporting, how much I follow and watch sport. I don't really follow football or cricket anymore. I used to support Man United. And again, it's probably a few boos there, I know. But that was purely because my dad did. You know, I'll put my hands up and say I just followed my dad and my brother followed in their footsteps. To be fair, that was during the... And again, I'm not going to show my football knowledge very well here, but during the 80s, so I think it was just before everyone started supporting Man United. So at least I feel a bit more comfortable with that. I suppose it'd have to be United. But as I said, I don't really follow football anymore. I just don't like all the numbers and, you know, the amount of players, the conveyor belt of players, really. So it doesn't really float my boat anymore.
Hey, fair enough. I mean, my Lancastrian co-host would like your choice of Man United. He's a massive United fan. Is Joe Nutsy Nuttall, but thankfully he's not here on the podcast to lecture about the history of Manchester United Football Club today. But Ben, in those early years, you mentioned about your dad being a massive role model and influence into your early stages of your cricketing journey. But who in the world of cricket itself did you look up to? Did you have any idols or role models that you tried to emulate in your cricketing game, per se?
I think really early on, it was Nutty. It was Alan Knott. My dad, like, again, very, very early on, I remember my dad bought me a video, you know, old school, big clunky video that went, you know, into the VHS player. And I would just watch it. And it was, I think it was the top, it may have been the top 10 wicket keepers. I think it was around that time. But we're talking, goodness me, Bob Taylor, Alan Knott. Well, do you know what? Honestly, I think it was only Alan Knott that I remember watching. I think that the first thing that jumps into my head was this running catch that he took. You know, obviously there was lots of diving catches, standing back and what have you, but there was one real skyer, and I remember just watching as the camera, old school camera, panned across and watching running through. He was just very nimble, wasn't he? He was, and I think that was probably my real earliest kind of trigger, certainly for keeping. And then obviously cricket as well. So yeah,
I mean, fair enough. Alan Knott, of course, for those who don't know, an absolute legend of Kent County Cricket Club, one of the great wicket keepers here in England and Wales. Absolute legend. Have to mention another one as well, Ben, someone who you probably did watch maybe a little bit later, but Jack Russell as well. That was a pretty golden era for wicket keeping, wasn't it? The art of wicket keeping, it was a very, very nice age. And I always speak to older cricket fans as well. They always look back fondly on Alan Knott, Jack Russell, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, fantastic keepers. Another one, Keith Piper, from my county of Warwickshire. I mean, yeah, what of course, yeah. That was for wicket keepers.
Yeah, I mean, when we really get into the crux of the good keepers, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Jack was fantastic. I had the pleasure of playing against Jack quite a bit in my early years, which was obviously huge for me. Alex Stewart was definitely up there, mm-hmm. as well. I mean, not necessarily as a purist keeper, but as the full package, I mean, he was unbelievable. And then again, I actually had the pleasure of playing with him when I first signed at Surrey. So, gosh, I was seriously blessed when it came to meeting these guys and learning from them, you know, early on in my career. So, yeah.
Yeah, not bad names, that, at all. And of course, at Surrey as well, we'll touch upon this, understudy to Jonathan Batty as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably one of the best things that could have happened to me, actually. So I started at Middlesex. I grew up through the Middlesex age groups. And then I was given an opportunity to play second team cricket when I was 16 at Middlesex. And I did quite well. And I, you know, I kind of served a bit of an apprenticeship there. And then when sort of the crux, and I'm really trying to dig into my memory now. I think there was a guy, it was Brown. Brownie, there we go. Let's just go with Brownie, who was the Middlesex keeper for years as well. He was fantastic. He was, you know, he was a gun. And then I think Nashie had just kind of started to nudge him out of the way. And they were looking for a second keeper. And I was 16. And I remember having a meeting with Gat and Gunner, as in Ian Gould and Mike Gatting. And them, you know, quite clearly saying, look, Scotty, we would love to give you a go. But if you're going to be the second keeper on the staff at 16, anything happens to Nashie, we've got to throw you in the first team. I don't know if we could do that. So then obviously I didn't get the opportunity that soon on. And then a year later or so, Surrey stepped in and offered me a contract to go there. Now, this is what I'm saying, because obviously I went to Surrey being the third keeper in line, where they had Alex Stewart, who was on England duties most of the time. Batty was the predominant keeper there. Mm-hmm. But then that did actually give me a bit of breathing space. So that was really my door in. And once I was on that staff, as I said, with Alex Stewart being the first choice keeper and then Jonathan Batty being the second choice keeper, it just meant that I had, as I said, breathing space, but also room to learn. I was under no illusions that I was going to burst through into the first team as an 18-year-old kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I actually had to serve that apprenticeship fully in the second team and really earn the right to play. Mm-hmm. So I think that actually played to my advantage when the time came. And obviously, as it happens, the opportunity came to go back to Middlesex and then just snap that up and was hit the ground running, so to speak.
Of course. And Ben, we will touch upon that in due time, I suppose, because we will talk about Middlesex and your career down at the home of cricket. Mm. But just before we do, and your time at Surrey, why wicketkeeping? I wanted to ask this actually in today's podcast. Why did you want to become a wicketkeeper? Why weren't you a spin bowler, a seamer, an opening batsman? What was it about wicketkeeping that drew you in the first place?
Well, if I stand up, you'd get the answer. I'm about 2 foot tall. No, I'm actually taller than Nashie, believe it or not. But no, it's, I mean, yeah, I did kind of start, I suppose, when I was 7 as a seamer. Everyone tries everything, don't they? Mm-hmm. But, you know, bottom line is I could catch. And I wasn't afraid of the ball. And then I was really fortunate as well, because obviously the inspiration from the top level guys, but there was a couple of guys that were local to me, played at my local club, which was Wickham House. So there was a guy called Jitin Bal, who the name would mean nothing to a lot of people, but to a handful of people, it would mean everything. This guy was phenomenal behind the stumps. And yeah, I just remember watching him and just in awe. And then I didn't get an opportunity even at club cricket until I was, you know, quite a bit older because this guy was in front. You know, I'm playing sort of county cricket and I can't even get into my club side because this guy Jitin Bal was there. He was great to watch and he was a real inspiration to me. And it was his standing up, and I just wanted to be able to do that. I saw how quick he was and stuff. So then I emulated that early on, and then that became my thing. That's what I was kind of known for on the circuit was. Being able to stand up to pretty much anyone and sort of have that fearless element to my wicket keeping.
Mm. It's a good attribute to have, and it's something that we see nowadays, isn't it? And I think in particular one person in international cricket you need to stand up to as a keeper. So for Pakistan with Mohammad Rizwan, for example, is Mohammad Abbas, because it can really pin a batsman in the crease. Instead of guys coming out and just playing him off the front foot, going forward, taking the LBW out of contention, by having Mohammad Rizwan standing up to the stumps, it traps him on the crease. It prevents that from happening. It brings the LBW back into the game. So it's an interesting innovation, isn't it, with regards to wicketkeeping, in particular against seamers, and you don't see every single wicketkeeper having the bravery to do that, do you?
No, I mean, obviously you've named some very good reasons for standing up. One of the reasons I used to do it was actually, I mean, I'm not particularly an intimidating person at the best of times, but I certainly was behind the stumps because I would, and again, I wouldn't get in people's face in the same way that Nashie used to, but I was there and I was busy and I was always around and people knew I was standing literally right behind them. And I think, you know, quite often, I suppose in cricket, you can call it a lonely sport because the batsman's out there on his own. But actually, one of the last things you want is one of the opposition just nudging you from behind, you know, kind of just that's always there, making a little bit of noise. You can just see him in your eye line and you just know that you don't have that freedom at the crease as you'd like. So yeah, and then obviously it brought more dismissals into the mix and, you know, just gave us a slightly different dynamic to the side as well.
Of course, yeah. And again, it comes back to a word, I suppose, which is presence. You've got that presence behind the stump. It is almost creating that element of doubt, isn't it, in the batsman's mind. It kind of takes away that release shot, of course, as I mentioned, against Mohammed Abbas, for example, in international cricket. I suppose on the flip side of that, did you ever get injured standing up to the stumps? Were there any times where maybe you got cut off by a bouncer or a stray delivery? Did that ever happen to you as a keeper?
Is that a question that you knew the answer to, or because there was one particular incident where I was it was my first year back at Middlesex and I was standing up and but I was standing up to one of our real slow bowlers. It was a guy called Ben Hutton, I'm not going to say he'll kill me for calling him slow because he really was slow, but every now and again he could actually chuck it down with a decent bit of gas. And I just got into the habit. We had got into the habit of him bowling bouncers with me standing up, and it was fine. I'd see his bouncer really early, and I could take it without too many issues. But we were playing against North Ants, and I think it was David Sales who was batting. Again, a very very prolific batsman back in his day, and someone that Nashie always raves about as well. But So Ben Hutton bowled a bouncer. Salesy went for a pull shot. Now, obviously, my hands were in place for where the ball was going to go, but he got a bottom edge and it hit me straight between the eyes with no helmet on. And it smashed my nose to pieces. We had a guy called Stewie Clark. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So anyway, he's run up to me and basically, yeah, he said, "Do you want the good news or the bad news?" And I said, "Give me the good news." And he said, "The physio's on his way." So that was basically how bad it was. John Embry was our coach at the time, and he's had his nose broken more time than, you know, anyone. So he's sort of gone, "You'll be all right, Scotty. Let's just take you down the hospital and have a look." So we went down the hospital. They had a little sort of rummage around just to see if they could click it back in. But little did they know that it was an eggshell fracture. So actually the ball had shattered my nose. So they were trying to kind of put it back and it didn't really work. So yeah, that was the penultimate game of the year. And I came out of that and the doctors basically said, "Look, you've got 7 days until the swelling goes down. We can't operate on it. You're going to have an operation to have it all fixed up." I had two big black eyes. My nose was down here somewhere. And yeah, they said, "Yeah, we just need to wait 7 days and then we can have a look at it properly." So I said to them, "Right, well, in those 7 days, we've got the last game of the season." So 4 of those 7 days was the last game against Kent. "Can I play?" And the doctor said, "You could play, but if you get hit again, you will be in serious, serious trouble." So I'm like, "Okay, fine." So then I had to mull it over, obviously. Now, Nashie was the other keeper. Now, Nashie always had a knack of scoring runs when I didn't want him to, right? Basically, so as the other keeper. So I was thinking to myself, there's no way I'm giving him another game to basically get his spot back because he would have done. So I've said to John Embry, which he loved, I'm like, "No, I'm playing. I don't care. I've got two black eyes, big bust up nose, but I'm playing the last game." You know, they thought I was a hero, but, you know, inside I was cacking it. So we rocked up at Kent and I wore a helmet the whole game. So standing back, standing up, Everything. It was the weirdest thing ever. And I, obviously, when I went out to bat, I just got an absolute barrage from the guys. I can't remember who was bowling, but first ball in both innings was a bouncer, and you know, just got absolutely peppered. Oh yeah, they didn't. You know, they wouldn't take any prisoners. It wasn't a case of, you know, let's go easy on Scotty because he's got two black eyes. You know, so they went quite hard. And then after that, sorry, I know this ends up being a longish story, but after that, I ended up in hospital a couple of days later with like hemorrhaging in my nose. So I basically woke up in the middle of the night and my nose was bleeding, and then it started coming out of my mouth. It turns into a bit of a gory story. I went into hospital and they couldn't stop the bleeding for about 3 hours. They kind of mopped it all up and they packed me on my way and said, look, it's just trauma. You got hit with a cricket ball, you know, so it's to be expected. And then a few days later, it happened again, except this was a real bad one. I was rushed to intensive care. I basically was gushing blood out of my nose and out of my mouth. I was covered. It was like a war zone in there. And yeah, they said that, look, I think we're going to actually have to do full on surgery, cut into the neck to take the blood supply off because we don't know what's going on. And then I was fighting the doctors to pin me down to actually take me into theatre because I genuinely thought that was it. You know, it sounds like an overreaction, but blood was coming out from everywhere. I'd been bleeding for at that stage 10 hours without any stopping. They had blood going in and blood coming out, and it was one of those kind of horror stories. And bottom line was, I mean, they went in, obviously they sorted it all out and had a look. But the bottom line was, when the ball hit me, my nose shattered. And a small piece of slither of bone had shot into the back cavity of my head. So it was basically was causing like internal bleeding at the back cavity of my nose, or the kind of hollow section there. So they were never going to see it. And it was always going to be an issue. So then that was it. So I was in hospital for best part of 2 weeks. I lost so much weight. I mean, again, fortunately, I always say this is a bit of a joke, but I still didn't miss a game because of it, because I played that penultimate game. Then I had the whole winter. I had 6 months to get ready for the following season. So the road to recovery was very long because that actually did shake me a bit. You know, if someone would even flinch on move on the other side of the room, I would flinch. I found it very, very difficult to come back from that. So the whole of the winter was me just trying to coax myself back into, you know, an element of courage. I was sort of bouncing a tennis ball off the wall and trying to catch it right in front of my face without flinching. It was a long road back. It was a long road back. And then we went to India for a pre-season tour. And that was my first time properly with a kind of cricket ball and stuff. And I was only about 5 minutes into my first net. And Morgie was, as in Owen Morgan, was in the net next to me, and he went down for a sweep shot, and he busted in the ball, basically top edge straight into his nose. So he's sort of got up with a bloody nose, but I'm the one who's throwing up in the corner because I just felt awful. I was going, oh, that's made me feel really, you know, sort of sick and stuff. So, I mean, it was fine. I came back and, you know, to cut the crux of it really was that's when I started wearing a helmet standing up. So, yeah.
Like, I'll tell you what, danger's a wicket keeping though, isn't it? Well, that's the thing. For the most part, cricket is a relatively safe sport, but we do have these injury horror stories. And my goodness, that's a horror story. That really is. I'm going to be honest, I didn't know about that. I did not know about that at all. So
that's why I thought it was a loaded question when you said, have you ever had an injury? Wicket keeping. But I mean, as I said, fortunately, that was it. And, you know, I didn't break a finger. You know, I had a 15-year wicket-keeping career and I didn't break a finger. I like to tell people I used to catch it in the middle, so there was no problems there. And nothing else really bothered me, which is obviously sentiment to the way that I sort of approached my fitness and stuff whilst I was playing as well.
Fair play. I'll tell you what, fair play to coming back from an injury like that. I know quite a few people who wouldn't. I mean, I don't think I'd be able to personally. God, you'd never see me behind the stumps again after that. I'm going to be honest. That is
it's a real shame that it wasn't in the iPhone era, because I just had I remember at the day back in the day, it was one of the really early photo phones. So it was really granulated and stuff, and goodness knows where those photos, but I've got a few, a few years ago, I managed to find a couple of photos of me with the nose down here and my eyes sort of, you know, sort of battered up and stuff. I mean, I had a slightly darker beard and no grays in my hair at the time, but yeah, it was pretty brutal.
Yeah, well, I'll say I can imagine. I've never been injured to that extent. I'm going to be honest, like, finger injuries, fair enough, thighs as well, knees, all that sorts, but God, no, never to that extent. But I suppose, Ben, we have to talk as well about David Nash. Because, again, David Nash was a Middlesex stalwart. I mean, we've had him on the podcast. He was a massive character. Fought a lot of off-field battles as well, didn't he, that many people didn't actually know about. So he's a very, very inspirational character, of course, gone into to writing his book now. But how big of an inspiration was he for your early cricketing days then? In terms of wicket-keeping, how much of a positive influence did David Nash have on your wicket-keeping journey?
Well, I mean, firstly, to touch, I mean, I've literally just finished Nash's book, and it's great. It's absolutely fantastic. And you're right, he does go down a road that a lot of people need to understand better. There's no doubt about it. And a lot of the stuff that that he talks about, we did speak about at length back in the day. We were quite open with each other. I think we were a very good pair. You know, I'm certainly not afraid to say it anymore. I mean, he had me covered with the bat. You know, he was very crafty. He was a stayer. He used to, you know, think very heavily about his batting. And I would have definitely had him covered with the gloves. And we were quite, we knew that. So then it was whatever the game, you know, if I was kind of in nick, then I would get the nod. You know, if I was hitting the ball well, then I'd get the nod because of my keeping. And obviously if, you know, vice versa, he would get the nod. But so in terms of the keeping wise, we used to wind other sides up, because whenever we used to practice together, it was really quite soft practice. You know, like we just throw tennis balls at each other, and it wasn't particularly intense training. I used to try and practice whilst I was playing. You know, the way that I used to see playing, certainly like 4-day cricket, you're out there for a long time, so that was my practice: be bloody good whilst I'm out there, as opposed to spending hours and hours and hours catching balls. I think I did that as a kid, and then when the time came to play professional cricket, it was putting into practice. You know, I'm not saying that's necessarily great advice for any young wicketkeeper out there, but that's probably the way that me and Nashley approached it.
It's very different to John Simpson, who of course again would have been a teammate later down the line, because he mentioned to us on here on the podcast about him always catching balls. And funnily enough, he had a story about Murali Kartik as well, which found quite funny, of course, former teammate at Middlesex, about him almost bouncing balls off of Murali Kartik's house and catching them like that. And that's how he kind of develops his wicket-keeping skills. But it's interesting, of course, in cricket, it's about individuality, isn't it, at the end of the day, when it comes to your training. And you mentioned, and I think David Nash as well, I think Nashy as well was quite similar. He didn't really train very hard in the nets. But then when it came to game time, I mean, just on it like that, it was a cracking wicketkeeper for Middlesex. But I suppose, Ben, from your time with the Saxes down at the home of cricket, I mean, first of all, what a ground to play your cricket at week in, week out. But what do you say was your favourite moment? What was your highlight from your time down in London?
My first century at Lord's was up there. Yeah, that was obviously a big milestone for me. I suppose obviously winning the 2020 was huge. That was one of the real highlights. And then that just led on to so many other highlights. I mean, that really was the catalyst, because from that we went to the West Indies and played in the Stamford series, which again, you just get treated like, you know, proper superheroes out there, which was phenomenal. And then all the scandal that kicked off out there, and just the whole experience was really, really interesting. And it's a great one to look back on. And then I got selected to play for the England Lions in New Zealand, and flew out there with them and had a really successful tour out there. So yeah, I mean, there's loads and loads of you know, firsts, and a load of really good memories that I have at Middlesex, certainly.
Fair enough. That's nice to hear. And of course, for any Middlesex fans as well, that'll probably put a nice smile on their face hearing about those good times. And 2008 in particular, we have to touch upon in more detail, because that finals day was pretty topsy-turvy, wasn't it? It was a very, very compelling final down at the Aegeus Bowl in Southampton. What do you actually remember from that day and from the game itself? What do you remember and recall from 2008 finals day?
Well, it was a massive part of Middlesex's history. I mean, obviously, we hadn't been good at, and probably haven't been any good at 2020 cricket whatsoever. And for whatever reason, that year, everything just clicked. We got the right team. Everyone was in nick, and everyone was doing what they were supposed to do. I don't want to be that guy that says that we kind of invented this system or anything like that. And I've got no idea, but I don't remember many sides doing the kind of one over thing that we did until that point where, you know, Tim Murta would bowl the first over and Dirk Nannies, I mean, ridiculous player to have in your side, would bowl the second over. And then you'd have Henderson bowl in the third, and then you might get Murali Kartik bowl. You know, I don't remember many sides kind of doing that as much as we did. In those sort of early rounds of that, and then just sort of we just run with it, to be honest. We kept winning, and it just happened. And then obviously we ended up on finals day, which was really interesting for me because I was supposed to be best man at one of my best mate's wedding, and it was interesting because he said to me, look, will you be best man? I said, yeah, of course I will, mate. That'll be fantastic, and sort of started writing the speech and what have you. And then the fixtures came out, and they said, so the finals day is on the wedding day. So I've obviously said to my mate, there's no chance we're making it to finals day. Come on, we haven't even come close for years and years and years. So don't worry about it. And then we gradually got closer and closer and closer. And then I don't know if you remember the quarterfinal was against Lancashire at the Oval. So because Middlesex Lords was being used for a test match, I think. And then they said to us, look, do we want to play a quarter final at an outground, or do we want to go to Lancashire? And we're like, no chance. Like, it has to be in London. So then they obviously approached the Oval, and so that became our home ground, which is one of the weirdest things ever. So they turned the Oval pink, so to speak. And we played that game. And that was the game that David Milan played his first game for Middlesex and scored that 100. Out of nowhere, which has completely set us up. And they threw me in at three, I think, for some reason. Like, Ed Joyce was the captain, and he said, right, Scotty, you're hitting the ball well at the moment. You can go in at three. So I'm like, brilliant, fine. So then we went bang, bang, and I was in like the second or third over facing Flintoff and thinking, well, you know, this is brilliant. All right, okay, fine. And then I actually was hitting the ball quite well at that time, and I just carved one straight off the middle of the bat, straight to Percy or whatever his name is. He took like a big diving catch, and then that was the end of me. And then David just came in and basically stole the show and took it. And where I'm kind of going with that is at the end of that game, obviously meant that I wasn't going to be able to go to my mate's wedding as best man. So I kind of thought, well, if we do win, let me just set up a kind of contingency plan. So my brother was at the game, and as I came off the field, I walked straight to my brother and delivered the speech for the wedding on camera, like straight to my mate, because I had it all. And I basically did the speech there with you know, sort of 15,000 people in the stand behind. It was obviously a bit loud. And then another friend of mine actually played it at the wedding. So that ended up being my speech at his wedding. So, yeah, that's one of the other things I remember about the whole kind of build up. But the day itself is obviously a bit of a blur. You know, it was just phenomenal. Yeah, you're right, it really did go down to the wire. One of the things people don't often realize about that game was that Hendo actually went for something like 60 or 70 runs off his four overs, but he's actually hailed as the savior of, you know, the guy that actually won us the game, which he did, because obviously he bowled those last couple of balls. But yeah, I think the Kartik was obviously amazing in those periods, and we had Sean Udell as well, which is an unsung hero when it came to that those particular games. So yeah, it was just a phenomenal day, wasn't it, all around?
Yeah, for Middlesex fans, absolutely. I mean, we still talk to Middlesex fans who were there and remember it as well, because it is a massive part of your T20 cricketing history, I suppose. It is the only T20 Cup to date down at the home of cricket, and you mentioned about Murali Kartik. It was Rob Key, wasn't it, that you caught? And it was a really, really quite sharp catch, just reflex like that, gobbled up in a second. Was it bottom edge? Am I correct?
Yeah, I think it was just the top edge. Who knows what it was? It was nick it, I promise. Kartik was fantastic for us. He really, really was. He was positive. He was a positive cricketer. You know, I mean, like, he had run-ins with people, you know, because he was quite stubborn at times, but the way that, you know, how positive he was just really rubbed, you know, that rubbed off on people, I think, which is a great thing.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. Murali Kartik. We've had some fantastic stories about him. Mentioned about John Simpson, talking about him earlier. Yeah. Seems like quite a nice guy. And of course, he's now moved into commentary, hasn't he? He was there for the India tour and of course has been doing the IPL, which is unfortunately suspended now. But yeah, Murali Kartik, what a bowler. Great, great bowler. Very wily customer, wasn't he? Murali Kartik always.
He was. Yeah. I actually felt really, I think he was a victim of 2020 cricket as well, though. I think because it was kind of when he first came to us in 4-day cricket, he was phenomenal. Like keeping to him, when you knew you had him up your sleeve, you could, you know, it wasn't like having a strike bowler. I mean, he obviously was a strike bowler, but he was also a bowler that could fit so many other roles. So if you needed to tie up someone for a period of time, or you needed to kind of shepherd the strike or whatever, you know, or get them to shepherd the strike, whatever it is, he could do that. So he wasn't just there to take wickets. He could also, you know, he just had so many sort of strings to his bow when it came to his bowling in 4-day cricket. And then after that 2020, he obviously, you know, put himself in the limelight because he you know, he did really, really well for us. I never felt that he kind of had that same sort of emphasis in 4-day cricket as he did before. And I think that just came from, you know, the style of bowling you have to have as a spinner to play 2020 cricket. And I don't know whether that is the case with other people, and I may be speaking out of turn, but that just how it kind of seemed to me with him. But in terms of the team, I mean, it's in terms of an overseas player who actually gives his all for the county, there wasn't many that would beat the way that he was with us. I mean, when he played his last game, he got awarded a cup, like a glass, which had Murali Kartik, Middlesex 2009 or whatever it was. And I remember it was at the end of season dinner kind of thing, and it smashed on the floor. And I remember he was so upset. It was ridiculous. He was almost in tears. And I remember actually getting that shard of glass that had his name, and it was like literally Murali Kartik, or it said like Kartik and it had mid on it or something like that. And just before they whisked it away, I got that shard of glass and I kept it for him. I don't know if he'll ever remember that, but I did. I kept it for him and I gave it to him a bit later on, just because you could see how much he the club really meant to him. So yeah, great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wonder if he's still got that piece. Probably not.
I doubt it. I think he's got a few, you know, he's probably got about 20 rooms in his, you know, mansion in Delhi, but who knows?
No, as you said, great, great player, great servant to Middlesex County Cricket Club as well. Murali Kartik, just a fantastic cricketer, really was. But I suppose, Ben, there we've been talking about highlights, but of course, cricket, unfortunately, isn't that simple. We call it the roller coaster here on the County Cricket Podcast, because you have lots of ebbs and flows. It's not as simple as great moments, highlights, victories, big scores. You do also have rough periods as well. You do have tough moments and moments where you feel as though the game's almost going against you. And I suppose the thing I wanted to ask, other than the injury aside, I mean, that would have been a tremendously tough period as well. Were there any other really tough moments that stand out to you from your time at the Home of Cricket? Were there any moments where you thought, I don't know, really struggling to get through this per se?
Nothing that was too sinister, if I'm really honest. I mean, I was very fortunate in that cricket, I mean, as I kind of touched with you just before we started, that I don't really watch too much cricket. I think anymore, I don't think cricket was the be all and end all for me. You know, I had a very strong family unit. I, you know, had other interests. I grew up rollerblading and, you know, playing guitar and stuff like that. And then fitting in a bit of cricket and catching a ball every now and again, you know. So when it came to, was cricket my life? You know, to other people, it would have seemed like it was my life, but to me, it wasn't really. Whereas I think a lot of people, it is completely their life. You know, that's all they do all the time, all week, you know, every single weekend growing up. And then they go into it and they finally make it. And then if something goes wrong, you know, there's no fallback plan whatsoever. And it's not that I necessarily had a fallback plan, but I certainly had something else. You know, my mind wasn't completely just as a cricketer. I never wanted to be defined as a cricketer. You know, that was never what I, you know, I didn't want to get to the end of my life and, oh, that was Ben Scott, the cricketer. No, I wanted to be, you know, known for other things, really. So I think I kind of navigated that quite well. And you had Nashi on the podcast. And obviously, I'd certainly encourage people to read his book. It is really, really insightful. And I spoke to him about this recently. I think I was also lucky to get away from Middlesex for a couple of years and be at Surrey, because I think that was a very good environment to be in. You know, as I said to you before, I was well and truly rooted in the second team, because the first, and so were a lot of us. It was me. I mean, the second team I could read out would be a first team nowadays. Yeah. You know, it was myself, Ricky Clark, it was Tim Murta, it was Michael Carberry, it was Gareth Batty, it was Jason Ratcliffe, Nadim Shahid. There was a lot of, you know, guys that were Scott Newman, a lot of guys that went on. And then actually some of the youngsters, so like Jason Roy and Stuart Meeker and, you know, those guys, that they were the youngsters that were coming through as well. So basically, yeah, going to that environment, but having the guys in the first team, you know, your Alex Stewarts, Graham Thorpes, Tudors, Bicknells, Hollyoaks, you know, you name it. I mean, you know, Butcher, you know, it was ridiculous place to learn. So that was a very positive experience for me. And I also, you know, the Surrey Stratters, they were always told it was well known that, you know, they'd strat around. But to be fair, it was a bloody good side. Like, you know, you would forgive them for doing that. However, at Middlesex around that time, and again, I don't want to sort of badmouth anyone, but you've probably got some guys that maybe felt they were better than they were. And that's not coming from someone that was necessarily like an amazing, you know, county cricketer. But I think that environment did... It was almost like instead of just getting on and trying to do better, I think it was, if I can drag someone back, it will make my performances not look so bad. Mm. I think that was almost the kind of environment that was there. And as I said, I kind of got snapped away from that. And I think Nashi was sort of caught in that for a period of time. And I think that's why, you know, he struggled with some of the things he did and a few people did in that kind of environment as well.
Spot on. And in fact, he mentioned that, and something which has stuck with me since that podcast actually is celebrating your teammate's success. And that is something which during that period, he did allude to that, funnily enough, that that they struggled to do as a unit. But of course, things did begin to change. I mean, 2008, of course, and since then, things have been better at Middlesex. But yeah, it's not great to be in an environment like that, especially as a young player. You need that support role. And I suppose you did have that at Surrey. So honestly, Ben, I'm glad that you didn't have those tough moments in cricket, and I'm glad that you did have that outlet away from the game. It is important, of course. You cannot be enveloped by cricket. It cannot be the be-all and end-all. You need that escape almost sometimes, because it can get overwhelming. As you mentioned, for guys who are going out there week in, week out for years on end, and then things don't go their way, and they're suddenly scrambling for ideas, trying to get themselves out of this rut, it can be very, very dangerous and destructive, of course, in both a physical and mental way. So yeah, it's important. And honestly, I'm glad because it's never nice to hear of players struggling during their county careers. But I suppose, Ben, before we go on to this or that and your life away from cricket, what do you remember from your last ever county game? Because it's 2012, you're playing for Worcestershire at this moment, 2012 as well as a year very, very memorable for myself as a Warwickshire fan, with us lifting the trophy, that iconic scene of Jim Charlton and the boys lifting the trophy at New Road. But what do you remember from that final game? What were you feeling on that day?
I always remember my last, not my last game that I played in, but obviously the last game that I remember being around Worcester was actually against Middlesex, believe it or not. Because we played that game in Durham, and then we had the meetings, you know, sort of discussing whether I wanted to carry on playing or not. And you know how that transition was going to take place, and basically I don't want to say I read the card on the wall, but I was coming back down to London, so I kind of knew that I was never going to be living in Worcester. Right? Nothing against Worcester, absolutely beautiful place, crying out loud, what a lovely, you know, town, what a lovely place to play your cricket. But I'm a London boy, and I wanted to get back down here. You know, I knew this is where my life was going to be. So as you know, scores weren't going my way, I started getting back down to London and just sort of diving into my little black book a little bit and just seeing what opportunities might be there. So obviously, if things didn't work out with Worcester, I would have potentially looked at another club. I know Hampshire were potentially interested, and who else was it? Well, Warwickshire actually had an issue with Ambrose, I think, that following year. So they did actually ask me if I could come on loan, but I'll get into that in a second. But the but the bottom line was, I actually bumped into a really good, who is actually a really good mate of mine, even now. And and he was opening a gym. And he basically said to me, look, the we're opening this brand new center in the center of London, like literally in the city, in between St. Paul's Cathedral and Bank Station, which is prime real estate. And we're taking on ex-professional sportsmen, you know, bodybuilders and lots of different types of trainers, personal trainers and nutritional coaches. We'd love you to come on board. And I'd qualified as a personal trainer. I'd done, you know, a lot of that whilst I was playing cricket. So then I kind of went back to Worcester with that little kind of carrot dangling. Mm-hmm. And I just thought to myself, do you know what? Okay. Who gets handed a second career on a plate like that? And I think it was a case of going into that meeting with Bumpy, and he pretty much said, Scotty, do you want to carry on playing? And I've kind of gone, do you know what? I don't know, Bump. And we kind of looked at each other, and I think we got that sense. And he was like, okay, fine. So let's call it a day then. Let's let you go, and we'll figure out, you know, how it all pans out. So then that was just before the Middlesex game. So then they threw Coxie in to play the rest of the season. There was no point me playing once I said I was going to go. And then I was sitting on the balcony with Angus Fraser. I was sitting in the Middlesex camp. It was ridiculous, you know, like chatting away with Gus. And Gus was brilliant. He came up to me and, you know, he basically sat next to me. He said, Scotty, you've got a job at Middlesex. Like, you know, like if you want to come on board as fielding coach, you know, we want your type of person involved with the club. So I ended up being the fielding coach for Middlesex for the next 3 years as a bit of a transition whilst I was building my personal training business, kind of thing. So that would be how my career, I feel, ended. I mean, other people would say I was just booted at the door, but that's how I kind of saw it unfolding. But no, just quickly to touch on the last game, now that you've reminded me, against Durham. It was the windiest day in history. I don't know if the records, if you even get the game up, I don't know if you, so if you speak to Moen Ali and speak to Alan Richardson, Daryl Mitchell, any of the guys that are kind of, that will remember that day, it was so windy that the umpires took the bails off.
Really?
Yeah. So they took the bails off because they kept falling off, right? It was so windy that they had to do that. Alan Richardson, I don't know if anyone remembers the guy. He was an absolute legend of county cricket. He was so good. He used to have this windmill action, and it was galing so much that he couldn't even do the windmill. He had to just run up and bowl like a layman, like a normal person. It was Paul Collingwood came out to bat and just kept falling over. I mean, I do take my hat off to Collie, because he came out to bat. And he was the only one that actually didn't complain. So a lot of the other youngsters would come out, oh, it's really windy, blah, blah, blah. He just kept falling over, but would just regain. You could see the professionalism in someone like that. Obviously, he played, you know, however many tests and millions of one day. But you could see he just kind of got on with it. But the highlight of that day was Moen Ali at third slip. He basically turned to me and said, Scotty, watch this. So I've looked over and it was so windy. He turned his head sideways and his beard just went like this. And it was just one of the funniest things I've seen on a cricket pitch. And I think it was a lovely way to go out.
Yeah, what a memory. A unique way to bow out as well, I suppose, as well, up at the riverside. I mean, it is notorious, isn't it, for the weather, whether it's snowing, raining, sleet, wind as well. Mm. But yeah, we do love Durham here on the County Cricket Podcast. Very, very nice county. Some good people up there in the northeast. But Ben, I suppose we have to talk away from cricket now, because after that, you mentioned about coaching, going down to Middlesex again. Angus Fraser as well, guy who I actually haven't mentioned on today's podcast, Mr. Middlesex, isn't he? Middlesex through and through. He will do absolutely anything for that club. Loves that club to absolute pieces. But how did you actually find the transition out of cricket? You mentioned there about having coaching, personal training as well on the side. What an opportunity that is, by the way, in central London as well. Sounds brilliant. But how did you actually find the transition away from the professional game? Was it quite simple for you? Or did you find it difficult?
It was for me. I mean, I will put my hands up. I was extremely lucky. I mean, people say you make your own luck. And yes, I did actually put the work in. I came back down to London. I explored my options I qualified as a personal trainer, strength and conditioning coach whilst I was playing cricket. You know, I think, and Nashi talks about this in his book in terms of preparing people for after cricket, and that's something that I think is really important. So I definitely had that in mind. For it to actually come to fruition that quickly and in the manner that it did, I was very, very lucky. And yeah, so basically, once I came back down to London and I started that business, as I said, Angus Fraser, you know, sort of got me on board with Richard Goatley, who's the CEO there as well, and jumped into that role as fielding coach. And I was around the boys helping out, and it was just nice to have, you know, I think they just valued having someone that had been around for a while, who was actually Middlesex through and through, really, you know, kind of around. And that helped out massively, because that obviously just was the scaffolding around where I was building my personal training and nutrition business. And then once that was up and running after 2 or 3 years, I kind of felt that it was time to let the cricket go, because, again, I didn't want to be, as I said earlier, it wasn't about being defined as a cricketer. And I figured out very, very early on that people don't know who you are outside of the game. They really don't. They don't, and I mean this with all due respect, they don't care. You know, like you've got to be good at what you're good at. And I learned that very, very soon. You know, I've walked into the gym as an ex-professional sportsman, you know, literally just waiting for clients to come flooding through the door to, you know, train with the famous Ben Scott. And they're just walking straight past me going, "Who? What's even cricket? I don't really care. I just want the best trainer." So very quickly, I realized I had to be good at training. I actually had to really know my stuff. I had to dive in and really unpick what I'd learned from being a professional sportsman and how I could, you know, help people with those skills. So when the time came, I did have to let cricket go for a period of time to actually do that. Do you know what I mean? It made sense to completely cut the strings and just become a trainer in my own right. And yeah, I dip into cricket every now and again. People ask me to do a bit of keeping coaching, and I'll go and play some benefit games with, you know, guys. I played a couple for Daryl Mitchell when it was his, and Tim Murters, and, you know, all of my mates that are still playing, that are kind of getting to that age now where they're having testimonials. I'd help them out and still be around, but yeah, most of my cricket days have been left in the past, kind of way.
Oh, I mean, it is a shame, isn't it, really, about that, well, I suppose, recognition, because in the game, Ben, I mean, I know plenty of people who remember your days at Middlesex. I mean, there's a reason why you're here on the podcast today. It's because myself, Joe as well, Joe did want to be on today's podcast, remember you for the Saxes. But I suppose outside of cricket, it is a very, what to say, it's a very intimate game. It's a very closed game, isn't it, cricket? Like, if you're in the game itself, everybody knows you. But I suppose outside, once you're outside the cricketing bubble, maybe there isn't that recognition. And as you said, you have to build your way up from the ground up again. It's not like football, for example, where you can just walk into a place, get mobbed, and opportunities come to you. You actually have to make those opportunities for yourself. But I am glad that you keep that little bit of cricket still in there. I am happy, because as a massive cricket badge, I mean, cricket is my life. I'm awful at the game, but I absolutely love it. Love talking about it, love writing about it, analysing it, whatever. And it is nice to hear that there is still that little bit of love for cricket. But I suppose, is there, how would I phrase this? Do you think you'd ever go back into a cricketing job? I think that's what I'm trying to get at. In the future, you've got your business now. Training, personal training, fitness, which is going well, of course, but would you ever be tempted, if the opportunity did come back into cricket, would you take it, yes or no?
So I kind of touched on cricket a couple of years ago with an online training platform called Kinetic Cricket, which is basically fitness specific.
Did you do that for the cricketer?
Yes, well, I did, yeah. So you may have seen that sort of dotted around. It's still there. It's still there as a platform. Again, it's a niche, isn't it? I mean, online trade at the time was, this is before lockdowns. I actually started this. So cricket's a niche when it comes to, you know, sports. And then you've got fitness in cricket. It's even smaller of a niche. And then online, it's even smaller of a niche. So finding the people to actually kind of buy into that was quite tough. So it is still there and it's still running. It's not a huge thing at the moment. But would I get back into cricket? It would depend on the stage of my life. I think at the moment, no, because one of the releases from moving away from cricket was not having to travel. It was actually, you know, the traveling and playing in front of, you know, crowds and stuff like that is great in your 20s, you know, not so bad in your early 30s. And then as you start to see life, or for me, you know, as I started to see life starting to solidify, that wasn't what I wanted. You know, I've got a 2-year-old now, Jaya, and the thought of up and going away for 4 days and doing a, you know, three month stint around the world or whatever it might be, doesn't float my boat at all. I couldn't think of anything worse, actually. And that's the thing. I mean, like, you know, like when it, because I've done it as well. I mean, that's the thing. A lot of, because I look at some people that want to get into coaching that maybe didn't make it, or they're, you know, fitness coaches that want to coach sports teams, you know, I was the, I played in those sports teams, so it, I don't feel like I'm missing anything by not being involved in it. Not really. That being said, if the right offer came around at the right stage, you know, I might take it. I mean, I certainly wouldn't say no to an IPL gig. Anyone's listening, and you know, kind of thing. But no, not the day in, day out sort of county grind, as we used to call it. I don't think that would be something that would interest me anymore.
You know, that's fair enough. And that takes me back to The Edge, which is a brilliant documentary. Cannot recommend that enough. We talk about it all the time here on TCCP. And it was Graham Swan. And he mentioned about that cricket and cricket touring in particular is brilliant. But as soon as you get a family, you know, the shine comes off it. But when you don't have a family, it is one of the best things on the entire planet to do. But no, yeah. Ben, you have to think of yourself, don't you? At this stage, you've gone in that direction. And to be fair, it's working. I mean, that's the most important thing. And I'm guessing that you are going to continue with the personal fitness, the training, the nutrition heading into the foreseeable future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, so, you know, I'm an experienced coach now, a trainer and a nutritional coach. So but obviously lockdown has changed the face of that as well now, which, you know, for me, you know, a silver lining. I know so many people have really battled with the lockdowns and their jobs and just, you know, the mental health side of it. I've, again, been really fortunate. I've genuinely seen a silver lining. I've managed to pivot my business online. So you can't quite see this, you know, for the listeners, we're on a Zoom call, but I've got a big all singing, all dancing screen. I've got multiple cameras around my gym at home. And Aaron can see my gym. I've got, you know, sort of a setup. So I train my clients virtually through here. So I didn't actually stop a single day from the word go with lockdown. I basically told all my clients, this is what we're doing. We're all going online. You know, some of them were like, okay, all right. I said, sorry, we're doing it. Like this, you know, this is it. This is the way of the future now. And, you know, a year and a half into it now, it's really working. And I'm seeing the consistency in my clients has been fantastic because so many barriers have been removed. You know, gym memberships, just getting to gyms, just, you know, excuses are disappearing because they, you know, they're training in the living room, in their garden. You know, a lot of my clients have got their own gyms at home as well. So it's worked really, really well. And I'm really enjoying it. And as I said, the silver lining is I've spent the first 2 years of my daughter's life with her, which is fantastic. I can think of, you know, I mean, you're talking about going away for 4 days and away for months and stuff like that. My commute's down to the end of the garden, our garden office. So at the moment, I'm loving it.
You know what, Ben, that's really, really nice to hear. And of course, first of all, just for the audio listeners out here, yeah, the gym is an absolute sight. It really is. Full of cricketing memorabilia, some good gear in there. I mean, it's making me a little bit envious, I can't lie. It is an absolute beauty of a setup. It really is. Even got a cricket bat in there as well. Oh, it is a sight to behold. But
that, Ben, was for your benefit. That was for your benefit.
Hey, it's worked. It has worked. It has reeled me in like a fish to bait. But no, honestly, Ben, that is very, very nice to hear. And of course, I wish you the best of luck, mate. Of course, hopefully things will begin to, you know, become a bit more normal heading into the rest of this year, 2022 and beyond. But no, I'm glad to hear that you've really grabbed this opportunity, I suppose, and built on what you already had. And it's good to hear that you've been successful this year, mate. It really is. Very, very happy to hear that.
Yeah, thanks. It's obviously, you know, lockdowns have pulled people apart, hasn't it? I mean, people are going in one of two directions. They're either, so many people are getting out and getting fit and they're seeing that, you know, their diaries free up because of no commuting and stuff like that. And they're getting, they're running, they're training, and they're focusing on themselves a little bit more. And then you've got other people that have gone, you know, the other way in terms of just, you know, being very sedentary and eating the wrong things. And the fitness industry, the nutrition industry, and the mental health industry at the moment is just so important. It is the world is crying out for good guidance. And I think the experience that, again, this sounds like a plug, but the experience that I've got from professional sport and just kind of going through that has definitely helped me with my clients and helping them get through things like this as well. So, you know, again, it's a silver lining. Look back at how tough county cricket was. I can certainly see that there was a reason for it now.
Well, good. And again, it's a good attitude. It's a growth mindset attitude, isn't it, in that regard? And of course, out there for everyone struggling through this pandemic, we will get through this. Okay, there will be a point where we do get back to some normality. Keep safe, be sensible, in particular to our Indian listeners out there. I know it's been absolutely awful out there at the moment, having seen the scenes in and around the IPL. But as I said, we will get through this. It'll take time, but we will come out on the other side. So Ben, I mean, that pretty much wraps up our main segment. Just before I do let you go today, though, we do, of course, have our this or that segment, which is always interesting. So this is basically just 10 quick fire questions, mostly cricket orientated. The last one isn't necessarily about cricket, but are you ready for this or that?
I think I am, yep.
Right. First question then, Ben, test or ODI?
ODI.
Maybe a bit controversial to some. Test is best. The next one, Joe Root or Owen Morgan?
Oh, in what?
General cricket.
Owen Morgan by miles.
Yep. Not surprising as ex-Middlesex team, mate. Fair enough. This next one, Ben, or Viv Richards or Brian Charles Lara?
Lara. My era.
Great choice. Fantastic choice. Treble winner with Warwickshire. And 501 out. Next question, Ben. Cover drive or reverse sweep?
Oh, cover drive. Oh, cover drive or reverse sweep? I'm going to say reverse sweep.
Hey, fair enough.
I just remember an old girlfriend of mine telling me off for getting out reverse sweeping, and me saying, how do you know what I should be doing on a cricket field? So it's like, fine. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, fair enough. It's been a popular one amongst the keepers. It really has. Keepers love a sweep, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Moving on to our next one then, Ben. I think I know the answer to this one. IPL or T20 Blast? Which would you rather play in if you could?
IPL.
Yeah, fair enough. This next one, interesting this one. Win a Lord's final, but get out for a really memorable duck. Like this will characterise the rest of your career. Or lose a Lord's final, but score a magnificent 100.
Win a Lord's final.
Oh, great answer. Yes, very good.
By miles. I won most of the games we won, I had nothing to do with anyway. So,
fair enough. This next one, Ben, this is difficult for the England fans amongst us. Anderson or Broad?
Anderson.
Fair enough. Next one, Gray Nichols or Kookaburra?
Did you know that I was both?
Yep.
All right, okay, fine. I'd say Kookaburra.
Oh, Cook. I was going to say, there is one right there. If you didn't choose Cook, maybe...
It was only two brands that I used during my career. It was Gray Nichols and Kookaburra, but yeah, I think Kookaburra. To be fair, at Middlesex, in one of the... For a good few years, I think it might even have been 8 or 9 of the boys used Kookaburra. I think like Ed Smith was Kookaburra, Awais Shah was Kookaburra, Morgie was Kookaburra, I was Kookaburra, Joyce was Kookaburra, Dalrymple was Kookaburra. And what that basically meant, everyone was Kookaburra, but what that meant was everyone just got Morgies. So like whenever, like, you know, so he'd get a load of them and we'd just go, I don't need mine. What's the point of me even entertaining using mine? I'll just get one of, you know, borrow one of Morgies or one of Aces or something like that. But anyway.
Fair enough. And again, that does show a little bit of Nice research for this podcast. Had to look back for some of the old photos. Notice both. So, that was very specific for this particular podcast. Yeah. Moving on to our penultimate one then, Ben. Oh, this is a difficult one for keepers. Adam Gilchrist or Kumar Sangakkara?
Oh, God. I was about to say Adam Gilchrist without hesitating then because he had to keep to warm. But then obviously Sangakkara had quite a crafty little so-and-so he had to keep to as well, didn't he? So, wow, that's a brilliant question. Who would I rather have? So, I'm going to go for Gilly. Why not?
Fair enough. Or Sangakkara, though, very, very tempting. Great keeper.
I know. Yeah, of course.
Super.
I don't think Gilly was given the credit as a keeper that he deserved, actually. I think because he followed Healy, like Healy was just a keeper through and through, wasn't he? So, you know, anyone following Healy was going to be seen. And because Gilly could bat so well and was known for that, he was seen as a second string keeper, but he was phenomenal. He was very, very good. Because I did a handful of winters in Australia, obviously out there playing great cricket. And so I watched a lot of him around that time when he was sort of really bursting through and doing well. So, yeah, I loved watching it. Yeah.
Fair enough. And again, that is something with Adam Gilchrist. You could argue that he is almost one of the catalysts behind the modern wicketkeeper batsman who opens the batting and keeps. he was one of the first ones. He was a real innovator, wasn't he? And a fantastic batsman. So yeah, fair choice there, Ben. Can't really argue with that. I would go Sanger's purely because he had the Warwickshire connection, but yeah, either or, both absolutely legendary.
I mean, he was he was classy, wasn't he? I mean, Sanger Kadar was classy, and I'm very good with Vikram Solanki because obviously we played at Worcester together, and Sanger Kadar playing those years at Surrey, and I remember talking to Vic, and for someone like Vic to say this guy is different league, you know, it was a massive sort of sentiment. So yeah, that's why it's a very difficult question.
Yeah, it was. It was. And again, both absolute legends. And Vikram Solanki as well. Brilliant player.
Yeah, Vic was amazing. He was amazing for me as well. So when I went to Worcester, I lived with him for a period of time, with him and Ambika. And then my wife's Indian, and she actually went to Hindi school with Ambika, Vic's wife. And it was really interesting. Because I think when me and my wife got together, obviously, you see the mutual friends on Facebook kind of thing. She's like, how do you know Ambika Solanki? I'm like, how do you know? Yeah, it was one of those kind of things. So yeah, very small world. But Vic was fantastic. Really, like, phenomenal captain, phenomenal sounding board. Obviously, he could turn his hand to anything. I mean, he went into commentary and now he's like head at Surrey, and you know, he's got a law degree and he can fly a plane. I mean, the bloke's ridiculous. You know, he's not got much hair anymore, but he's you know, he's got more things to worry about.
Exactly, yeah, he can do it all. And was an absolutely phenomenal cricketer. Really was, Vikram Solanki. Moving on to our final one, Ben. I don't think you're going to buck the trend. I'm going to be honest. Every single player that we've had on has said the exact same answer for this. But half your height or double your weight?
Oh, God, what, for some of my height? Do you know what? I would double my weight.
We have not booked the trend, folks. We have not booked the trend because the rationale and the reasoning is always you can in theory lose the weight, can't you?
I kind of know how to do that as well. So
yeah, as a nutritional expert, yeah. Hey, fair enough, Ben. So yeah, that pretty much ends our this or that segment. So just before we do end today, Ben, do you just have anything to plug or promote? Social media channels? I mean, your fitness website, stuff like that, for example.
So it's scottkeepingfit.com. Obviously, a play on the keeping element there, and then which has been revamped recently with the help of David Nash, as it happens. So if you want to jump on there, obviously at the moment, it, as I said, just coming out of lockdown, it's really important that people are getting their lives back on track. And you know, my demographic really is the kind of 40 to 60. Guys that have struggled through it. So yeah, jump on there and have a quick look. And then the other one would be kineticcricket.com. Certainly, you know, with this podcast, guys that are interested in getting themselves in shape specifically for cricket, all of the programs on there are designed for batters, bowlers and keepers and all rounders. There's a beach cricket section on there as well for people that are a little bit more getting ready for the beach. And that's about it, really. So yeah, dive on, have a look and see if anything takes your fancy.
Well, there you go. And of course, Ben, we'll leave the links to those in the podcast description below. So for anyone who wants to go and check out those respective websites, please feel free to do so. But yeah, Ben, that does bring us to an end to what's been a fascinating episode of the County Cricket Podcast. Just from myself, thank you very much for joining me here today. It's been a pleasure having you on, talking all things Middlesex, fitness, cricket in general. And of course, you are always welcome back here at TCCP. But that does bring us to an end to today's episode of the Counts Cricket Podcast. To all of the listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.